You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. One of the most infamous crimes of the last half century occurred in June 2002, when 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart was abducted from her Utah home at knife point and held captive for 9 months. During those nine harrowing months, Ms. Smart was held against her will by a man and his wife who raped her and threatened to kill her and her family. Today, Elizabeth Smart is an advocate for change related to child abduction, recovery programs, and national legislation. The founder of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, Elizabeth has also helped promote the National Amber Alert, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, and other safety legislation to help prevent abductions. Elizabeth Smart has chronicled her experience in the New York Times bestselling book, My Story. She appears at Elizabethtown College tomorrow night as part of the college's lecture series. Joining us on today's Smart Talk, Elizabeth Smart. Ms. Smart, thank you for being with us today. Welcome to the program. During the 9 months you were in captivity, you were tethered with a wire around your leg, went days sometimes without food or water, threatened that you or your family would be killed on a regular basis, and raped every day and sometimes multiple times a day. In your book, you write that this is the question you're asked most often, but I'll ask it again. How did you survive or overcome that?
Well, it definitely wasn't easy. I remember so many times wanting to give up and just wanting to say, this is too hard. I can't keep going. I didn't sign up for this. I didn't ask for any of this to happen. I don't know if I can keep going. I remember thinking those kinds of thoughts, honestly, all the time. But I had also made the decision the first day that I was kidnapped that knowing that my family would love me and they would accept me back no matter what, that I was going to do whatever it took to survive. It didn't matter what it was. And so in those moments, whether he found some new way to rape me, or I had been withheld food or water from me, I would keep coming back to that decision I made on that first day. And I kept going. I just kept on holding on to believing that even if nobody else loved me, my family did, and that was enough, and I was going to do whatever I could to survive.
Well, you know, you said that you made that vow to survive on that very first day. You know, one of the things that struck me about your book as you were writing about those first days is that I got the sense that you couldn't believe this is happening to you. You say often that you were a little girl. You were someone who grew up in a happy home, and that it sounded like you were satisfied with being a child at 14 as opposed to many 14-year-olds who want to be adults. So what gave you that will to survive?
I don't think being a child makes you weak or doesn't make you being a child doesn't mean you're not intelligent or not able to make decisions. I mean, I look at my 6-year-old daughter right now, and she's pretty strong-willed. And the things that come out of her mouth, I'm like, dang it, I was really hoping not to have these kinds of conversations with you yet. So I don't think that's quite accurate to say that a child couldn't make those kinds of decisions. And when I say child, I don't mean that I was immature. I didn't know about sex. I didn't want to have sex. I had a very innocent mind. I just wasn't maybe as, I don't know, involved in wanting to be grown up at that point. I think that I recognize that as you grow up, responsibility came with it, and I was perfectly happy to enjoy my childhood as long as possible.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to infer that children weren't capable of making the kind of, or having the kind of thoughts that you did, but pointing out that, you had lived, you considered yourself, as you said several times in the book, as a little girl. In June of 2002, Brian David Mitchell abducted you from your bedroom and took you into his camp he had with his wife, Wanda Barzee. It was in the mountains of Utah. Mitchell called himself Emmanuel, and I'm not going to give him, refer to Emmanuel again in our conversation. He said he was a prophet from God, but he's been described over the years as a religious fanatic. From reading your book, he appears to be a con man. Was he, or did he truly believe he was on a mission from God?
That's a great question, actually. I think that he had started living this fake, this con, this facade for so long that it became easy to live that way. I think he found that it was the best way to manipulate people. It was the best way to get exactly what he wanted. I mean, you think of even that time period. So I was kidnapped in June, but only the prior September was when 9/11 happened, was the Twin Towers coming down. And I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, I feel like even in my limited perspective of that time period, that everyone kind of all became extra sensitive about religious extremism, about people who were different. I mean, at least that's how I felt where I grew up. And I think my captors saw that. I think they recognized that. And I think that, I mean, that was just another tool to them to manipulate those around them. Because, I mean, what do you say to a person if they're like, well, this is part of my religion? I mean, that usually shuts people down pretty quickly. And so they've been doing that for a very long time. And I mean, you can do just about anything and find some kind of, I don't know, reference in the Bible and twist it enough to make it, or at least this is what he did, to make it accepted, to make it okay to do, no matter how terrible it is.
Mm. And he talked constantly, from what you have said, that about himself. I mean, the guy sounds like a classic narcissist, or maybe even extreme narcissist, that he just talked constantly about his philosophies and about himself. As you were in captivity, you had to listen to this day after day.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he never shut up. I mean, I think sometimes I genuinely wondered what was worse, listening to him talk about how great he was, about how terrible, how sinful, how wicked I was, or actually being raped. I mean, I never thought before my experience I would have ever have said anything like that. And even sometimes now I look back and I think, wow, did I really say that? Did I really think that? I mean, that's pretty strong language in my opinion. But yeah, there were some times when I was just like, please stop.
And you also said that, just when you thought that you had reached the low point during this 9 months, that there always would be something lower. I mean, again, this gets back to survival, but I guess many people, and that's why they ask how you overcome this, when every new day seemed to bring a new low point.
Well, I eventually stopped thinking I hit rock bottom. I just eventually started accepting that day as the status quo and finding moments in that day that I could be grateful, because I realized that the next day probably would be worse. So I might as well take the moments that I could find them, whether it was, some silence or some sunshine or I had something to eat. I just found the things that day that I could be grateful for, because I didn't know if they'd be there tomorrow.
His wife, Wanda Barzee, showed no sympathy at all for you. That's even though her husband was taking what he called another wife and had plans to take on more wives. What was she like?
I feel like she is one of the, almost greatest female tragedies I've ever come across in my life, because this was not her first marriage. She had a marriage before she was married to Brian Mitchell, and she had 6 children in her first marriage, and her first marriage ended. I mean, I know what she told me, but I certainly don't know if it was accurate or not, but I guess I can believe that it was not happy because they ended in divorce. But regardless, I mean, she brought 6 children into the world. She was a woman. I mean, she could have been probably my grandmother, and yet she accepted what he wanted to do to me. She stood aside. She let him rape me. She let him chain me up. She let him hurt me. And she never once stood up for me. And I feel like as someone who had been a mother, as someone who had experienced unhappiness in her life, that she failed, womankind as another woman. I mean, she should have stood up for me. I mean, she should have never let him kidnap me. I mean, and what did she get out of it? For him to tell her that he loved her, for him to tell her that she was special, for him to tell her that, she, not to delve too deeply into, his, religious ideas, but that she would one day sit on the right-hand side of God? He told her all of these things, and was that really worth hurting a child? And now, she spent many of her later years in jail. She is out, but as far as I know of her, she doesn't have a great life. Her family doesn't have anything to do with her. I mean, was it all worth it? I can't believe that it was.
You sound almost perplexed by her.
I think disappointed is more correct. I mean, I remember first walking into the camp and thinking, oh, there's a woman here. Nothing that terrible can happen to me. I mean, obviously that was misled faith or misplaced faith in that moment. But, as someone who had children, who had raised children, she was allowing a child to be hurt this way. I mean, that is disgusting.
So, Elizabeth, I have to say that when you were finally freed from your captors, were able to get away. I mean, police officers showed up and asked questions, and finally a police officer asked, are you Elizabeth Smart? And at first you were a little hesitant, but you finally said, I am Elizabeth. Describe how that happened. Describe a scene on a bus beforehand. They had you disguised in, sunglasses and a gray wig. But there was a young man who was asking a lot of questions about Mitchell's religion. Do you think that he led police to you?
I think he knew something was wrong. I think that he was suspicious of something. Absolutely. I would totally believe that he called up the police afterwards. Hmm. I mean, as far as my knowledge goes of that day, there were multiple people who called the police that very day that I was rescued.
And they thought that you were Elizabeth Smart?
The police thought that I was Elizabeth Smart, or sorry?
The people who called the police, did they tell the police that we think this is Elizabeth Smart?
As far as I know, that there were multiple people, yes, that thought I was Elizabeth Smart. But, I mean, there could have been people just calling in being like, this is weird. This is off. This is wrong.
A question you're asked often, why didn't you run away during those 9 months?
Well, it was not for lack of wanting to or lack of trying. But it wasn't just that easy. I mean, my captors, I mean, they took pains to hurt me. They took pains to scare me. They took pains to strip away any sort of self-respect or self-worth that I had, so that I not only felt like I was disgusting and worthless, but that it felt like they became invincible. I mean, any time that he threatened to do something to me, he followed through with it. Anytime he threatened to rape me, he followed through with it. Anytime he, you know, threatened to withhold food from me, I mean, he followed through with it. These were not just idle threats. And when he started talking about trying to kidnap other young girls, I mean, he followed through. He wasn't always, well, thank goodness he was never successful again after me, but he always followed through, and he used to bring back newspaper articles from Salt Lake, from when he'd go down into the city to get food, or he'd bring back missing posters of me, and he'd show them to me, and he'd be like, oh, you can't believe Salt Lake. It is covered in light blue ribbons, and every sign and every tree and every window has your face taped to it or tacked to it. And everyone is looking for you. I mean, you're everywhere down there. But nobody is ever going to find you because I have you. And that seemed to be emphasized over and over and over again. I mean, I remember a helicopter flying so close overhead, so low overhead, that not only the trees were shaking around us, but I mean, the tent that he was keeping me in was shaking. I mean, I remember in the early day hearing someone yelling out my name, and yet none of these people, the helicopter, the people shouting my name, no one ever found me. And so when he would make the threat that if I tried to run, he would kill me, or he'd go after my family. I mean, that was a incredibly real threat to me. I mean, I absolutely believed that he was capable of killing me. I believed that he was capable of killing my family. And if he killed my family, if he went after them, what was the point of surviving? Because at that point, I still didn't know if people would accept me after I had been raped, after I had been abused. So those were very real threats that he constantly, daily made to me. So I didn't know if the police officers were, you know, able to rescue me or able to protect me, but I knew what he was capable of. And at that point in time, I felt like I had to protect myself, and I felt like I had the responsibility as well of protecting my family.
Something you just said, and this goes to what you are doing today, your advocacy today. You wrote in your book that very early on, after you had been raped, that you thought that your family would maybe not accept you, that they would never think of you in the same way, that you wouldn't have boyfriends or a husband or have children because you had been raped or assaulted. Now, many rape survivors have those same feelings, that somehow they're damaged and no one will want them. How did you get those thoughts out of your mind? Did it take after you were freed, or during the time you were in captivity, you realized that I'm not the guilty one here?
I always knew I wasn't the guilty one, but that, I mean, knowing that I wasn't guilty for what had happened to me, I mean, didn't make me feel like I still wasn't dirty. I mean, I got been raised that where, you know, you it was important. It was stressed a lot that I needed to be a virgin to be able to get married. And that's where a lot of these feelings of, you know, worthlessness, of, I don't know, feeling disgusting, feeling like I couldn't be loved, that's where a lot of it stemmed from. And nobody in all this time had ever spoken to me about the difference between enthusiastic consensual sex and rape. And just for the record, if you're not having enthusiastic consensual sex, it's rape. Like, you have to continually be enthusiastically consenting. Let me say that a few more times. Anything outside of enthusiastic consent is rape. And it can come from a boyfriend, a date, a friend, a parent, an uncle. Can come from anyone. It can be someone you know, someone you don't know.
So have you had occasion to talk with women who, or maybe even men, who have been raped and have had them, those same feelings of you, of inadequacy, or of not being wanted? What do you say to them, or what would you say to them?
Yes, I'm able to speak with survivors all the time. I mean, I can be out grocery shopping with my kids and they can, you know, be pulling on my pants and being like, I want a treat. And I can have someone come up to me and say, you know, I've never talked about this to anyone before, but, you know, I was raped too. And, you know, it's been hard. I've struggled. I've never been able to have a relationship since. I mean, that kind of scenario is common in my life, and I feel like that's a tragedy. So the things that I want to say to them are, first, that you are so much stronger than you think you are. I mean, I truly believe there's nothing quite as powerful, there's nothing quite as strong, there's nothing quite as beautiful as the human spirit. I mean, I'm continually amazed at what people are able to overcome. All the time. It's amazing. It's beautiful. And I'd want them to know that. They're stronger than they think they are. I'd want them to know that there isn't anything that anyone can do that can take away your value. So if you've been raped, that doesn't make you any less of a person. That doesn't make you any less of an individual. That doesn't take away your value, your worth. You're every bit as good as the person standing next to you. And then I would want them to know that, you know, we all feel like we have these defining experiences in our lives. I mean, I used to feel like I would only ever be known as the girl that was kidnapped. I mean, it's very easy to feel that way. It's very easy to feel defined by what you go through in life, but I actually don't think that it's what you go through that defines who you are. I mean, absolutely. Does it affect you? Yes. Does it maybe affect your choices in the future? Yes. But it doesn't define you. I think what ultimately defines you are the decisions that you make, how you react and how you respond and what you decide to do next. And I'd want them to know that. That power lies within them. And there are good people in this world. There are incredible organizations that are here to help. I've had the immense honor of meeting with so many of them across the United States. Their good still exists. And don't give up.
You, when did you decide that you wanted to advocate for children, for protecting children, for those who are survivors? When and how did you decide to do that?
It kind of started little by little. And my dad, I mean, he was in it up to his eyeballs when I came home. And as he would start going out, or as he was going out and doing things, he'd talk to me about it sometimes, and then he'd ask me what I thought, if I thought it was a good thing or how I felt about it. And then if I said that I thought it was a good thing, he'd be like, well, you know, it's like, I'm not pressuring you, this is up to you, but if you would like to be involved, I think you could probably make a pretty big impact. And that's kind of how it started. And it initially just started on abduction prevention and trying to help change laws on laws for missing children. It just kind of started out as that. But as I got older and I just realized how prevalent sexual abuse is and how little people are talking about it and how there are so many other issues that we see. And it feels like many of them stem from trauma that has been inflicted in people's lives, you know, whether it becomes an eating disorder or a drug dependency or self-harming. A lot of it feels like it was rooted back in their childhood or in their earlier life. And I'm not saying always, certainly not always the case, but I feel like much of the time it's because they've experienced some form of sexual abuse or abuse in general. And when I realized that there were so many other survivors in this world who experienced something similar to me, I mean, yes, the details are a little bit different for each of us, but ultimately what they went through wasn't so different from what I experienced. And I have a great support in my life. I have a great support network in my life. And I feel like I have the tools to help me stay healthy. So when I go down these dark pathways, I'm not consumed by it again. I can still have a healthy life and I have my boundaries and I can check myself. So if not me speak about it, then who should?
Are you happy?
Yes.
You are asked that question often too, aren't you?
Yes, I do.
Did you have to become happy again once you were freed, or just once you got home and realized, I'm home with my family, with my loving family, I can be happy once again?
I'd say both. I'd say both. I mean, because I definitely was happy. I mean, to this day, being rescued was, at least half of the day, was one of the happiest days of my life. But, I mean, I have felt anger, and I felt frustration and pain and sadness. I mean, I feel like I felt the whole spectrum of emotion. But I've, you know, been able to work through those emotions. I've been able to feel those emotions, accept them, and I'm in a place in my life now where I feel happy. And honestly, I don't feel like I'm that hard to please. I don't feel like it takes tons of things in life to make me happy.
Elizabeth Smart, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Elizabeth Smart will be at Elizabethtown College tomorrow night as part of the college's lecture series. Elizabeth, thank you for telling your story and for the kind of message that you're sending to a lot of people out there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.